This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk. This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, I'm Matt Chorley, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits. Coming up on today's episode, never mind 10 years to save the West. We bring you 10 minutes, or maybe a bit more, to save Liz Truss. We've read her book so that you don't have to. Frankly, I suspect no one else will. In our big thing today, we take a look at, has Liz Truss got a point about any of the things she's complaining about? And would it be better if she left the complaining to someone else? And as it's a Tuesday, we'll bring you a sneak peek of how to win an election. Peter Mandelson, Daniel Finkelstein, and Polly McKenzie. And given everything that's going on in the Middle East, we're also going to take a look at CRINCS, this group of China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea. Just how worried should we be about this new axis of evil? We'll take a look at all of those things today. And don't forget, if you like what you hear on the podcast, you can join me for Politics Without the Boring Bits, live on Times Radio, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. That's Politics Without the Boring Bits, weekdays from 10. And we begin with an apology. This morning, I went on the Today programme. No, that's not what I need to apologise for. I like going on. Nice to go. I was interviewed about Liz Truss's book, along with the Sun's Harry Cole, who was asked by Nick Robinson if there was a route back for Liz Truss.
She certainly wants some sort of backroom, sort of figurehead role, a sort of Keith Joseph to the next Thatcher sort of thing. And what she really wants...
Final word to you, Matt. Did that last suggest a certain scepticism of the idea that she's the intellectual giant who will remake conservatism?
I don't know about Keith Joseph to Margaret Thatcher. She's barely Keith Allen to Orville.
Now, that was a mistake. I shouldn't have said it. So I apologise. I should, of course, have said Keith Harris. Not Keith Allen. Keith Allen and Orville, that's a very different, that's a real late-night bender. So I would like to apologise, and I will be making a donation to a green bird sanctuary.
I wish I could fly right up to the sky, but I can't.
You can.
I can't.
You can, Liz.
I can't.
You can.
I can't. Yeah. I can't.
I know, in a huge surprise to all of us here on Politics Out the Boring Bits, Liz Truss won't come on to talk to me.
But, I can't.
But that won't stop you hearing from her book. Don't worry. We're going to be scattering her around the place today. Lettuce leaves scattered like rose petals.
Hello, Liz Truss here. I hope you enjoy my new book, 10 Years to Save the West.
Yeah, well, more like, was it 75 and a half Liz Trusses? 10 years. Thanks to Noreen Skinner. She's going to be bringing you bits and pieces from her book throughout the day. Now, as I write in the Times today, scientists use the mirror test to evaluate the self-awareness of different species. Snakes, apparently, they recently found have got self-recognition, joining dolphins, penguins, roosters, and even ants on the list. At the other end of the league table are sea lions, jackdaws, the cotton-top tamarin, and really lacking in self-awareness, the mercifully endangered species known as Liz Truss. Even holding up the pages of her strange book to a mirror will not help. She is physically incapable of self-reflection or self-awareness of any sort. And we'll reflect on that in our big thing later on. Before that, it's Tuesday, so it must be... Yes, it's How to Win an Election. Here's a little sneak peek of today's episode with Peter Mandelson, Daniel Finkelstein and Polly McKenzie talking about the management of expectations.
Now, there's been speculation that were the Conservatives to suffer a terrible night at the polls on the 2nd of May, that the PM will face a confidence vote by the parliamentary party. In response, it's been suggested he could call a general election. Could that happen? And if it does, could the King refuse his request to dissolve Parliament? Thanks very much, Adrian Jenner.
That latter suggestion, which is that he could call an election and that the there'll then be a decision that by the palace that not to accept this election, I don't think that would happen. I think they wouldn't intercede in politics in that way. So if you called an election, there'd be an election. And I don't think that anybody would call an election in those circumstances. A small possibility is that he might not, if there was an attempt to remove him from office, he might just go. I don't think that's absolutely impossible. I think it's not what I expect to happen, but not absolutely impossible.
Peter, this idea of one party being miles ahead and what that might, the impact that might have on voters, and the suggestion that, like, particularly in 2017, Theresa May was so far ahead, Labour MPs went around saying, oh, you can vote for me. Even if Jeremy Corbyn's not going to be Prime Minister, she doesn't deserve a big majority. Do you think that does have an impact?
I remember in 1997, when we were sort of miles ahead in the polls, Philip Gould, our great strategist and pollster, delivered a thunderbolt to the campaign team in Milbank the weekend before. Called us together and said, I've looked at all the research and I've got bad news. Our Polish lead is shrinking. Economic optimism is on the rise. John Major's approval ratings are also going up. Our focus groups now are not talking about a close-run thing, certainly not a landslide. We have got a big job on our hands in the coming week. And my God, did it send us an electric shock up us. And I think that was probably what was intended. I mean, it is the case that the lead was going down, as it will do for Labour as we get into the election campaign this year, whenever the election comes.
I love Adrian. I think all of these things are true, right? So the expectation management has got to the point of being not, you know, sort of inside baseball of inside baseball. It's where we are asking about whether the expectation management is leading to the management of expectations. And so you just get into this circular thing. So now we're talking about whether Ben Houchen holding on to his mayoral position will mean that everything's fine for the Conservatives. But I mean, of course it won't mean that everything's fine for the Conservatives, because as Danny reminds us regularly, local elections don't really tell you much about what's going on that you couldn't find from the polls, and they are often, particularly because of the distorted reporting that comes from expectation management, really less useful as an indicator of public opinion than the polls. But as Peter says, actually it matters because of internal motivations within SW1, within how motivated do your campaigners feel? How did they cope? And so the expectation management on the night, which shifts the reporting, can change the mood, not just of Westminster journalists, but also your backbenchers, who are just as likely to fall for the spin and all of that, however jumped up it is. And so if you are thinking about how do you get through the first 24, 48 hours so that you don't trigger a leadership election, then the expectation management does matter. It doesn't influence the voters. However, there is one thing that hasn't come up, which is the thing that does really influence turnout is the sense of whether it's going to be a big win election. If it's a foregone conclusion, then fewer people turn out.
And if you want to listen to the full episode, just head on over to How to Win an Election, wherever you're listening to this. Now, step away from all the slight silliness of Liz Truss and turn our attention to the small matter of World War III. The ongoing conflict in the Middle East could, if it continues to escalate, see the strengthening of an anti-Western global alliance. This alignment between China, Russia, Iran and North Korea has become known as the Krinks. It has identified a substantial threat to the established world order. So we want to take a look at that today with some experts, one for each of these countries. So the Times' China correspondent, Richard Spencer's here. Hi, Richard.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, very good, very good. Here to take a look at Russia is Mark Galliotti, a Russia expert, senior associate fellow at the Russi think tank. Hi, Mark.
Morning.
We've got also from Roosie, but an expert in Iran, Dr. Louise Kettle. Hi, Louise.
Good morning.
And Professor Hazel Smith is from the Centre of Korean Studies. Hello, Hazel.
Good morning.
So let's start then with, let's start in fact with Iran, Louise, because clearly that's the sort of the part of the crinks which is in the news right now. Can you explain the connections between Iran and the other crinks and what how worried we should be that the tentacles, if you like, of the Middle East conflict actually stretch right around the globe?
Yeah, so Iran has a good relationship with China, Russia, and North Korea. It is, I would say, an alliance of convenience because they have a shared opposition to the United States, to kind of Western alliance, and as you rightly pointed out at the beginning, the kind of established world order, which doesn't work for them. Many of these countries have suffered under heavy sanctions through that kind of alliance. Some of the countries, so North Korea, for example, and Iran have both sort of tried to defy the international community by pursuing nuclear weapons. So they've got that alliance through being against something, essentially. And they work together in different ways. They have kind of different relationships, and each relationship has some strengths and some weaknesses. But they fundamentally are trying to work together. They support each other across arms. They generally support each other fairly economically as well and diplomatically. So, for example, at the moment for Iran, China and Russia are providing some diplomatic protection in the United Nations Security Council.
What are there any connections, Richard Spencer, from the sort of Chinese perspective? Are there any connections that go beyond our enemy's enemy is our friend? We don't like the West, you don't like the West, therefore we're all on the same team.
Yeah, for China, it's somewhat different from the other countries because, you know, when you talk about the challenge to the New World Order and these sort of very grand terms that people talk about, China is also, while challenging that because it sees American dominance as a threat in the future, it's also been the greatest beneficiary of the New World Order. If you look at the country that's done best from the end of the Cold War, the globalization, all these things that we think of as the rules-based order, you know, to use this horrible cliche, which I try and avoid myself, but other people talk about it. You know, the country that's done best in the last 30 years is China. So it doesn't want to rock the boat too much, but it also fears that, you know, after America has, as it sees it, as the Middle East sees it, you know, destroyed half the Middle East, America is going to turn its attentions to China. So it's kind of playing a much more subtle game than Iran, which is, you know, sees America as an immediate existential threat, or the Islamic Republic does. It's a more subtle game that China's playing, and it's using a more subtle array of tools. You know, which are not just pragmatic. There is a principle of, long-standing friends must be stood beside. So, you know, doesn't like everything that North Korea does, for example, but it's been a long-term ally since the founding of the People's Republic, which coincided with the founding of North Korea as we know it. It has these sort of underlying principles of Chinese diplomacy that it stands by, and it thinks that this is the best way to secure China's interests. So it's not going to allow America, as it sees it, to bully Iran, to bully North Korea, even to bully Russia, for fear that China might be next.
And Mark Galeotti, clearly Putin has, we might say, delusions of the word, or certainly ambitions for Russia to be a global player. So does he see China in particular as a threat to that, or is actually being part of that anti-West alliance more beneficial?
Well, I think from his point of view, in some ways, he has no choice but at the moment to turn to China. And it's quite interesting. There's something of a generational shift inside the Russian elite, in that Putin and his immediate circle, who, let's be honest, are, you know, generally around 70 years old, give or take. From their point of view, the war in Ukraine, which as far as they're concerned is a wider war with a hostile conspiratorial West, is the war. It's going to define their political survival, their political legacy in the future, and so forth. So in some ways, they will make whatever concessions are necessary. And the Chinese know this. And frankly, the Chinese have been pretty unhelpful allies in this respect. I mean, the Chinese banks are withdrawing from Russia to avoid getting caught by secondary sanctions. The Chinese are not providing weapons directly, but only dual-use technologies, that kind of thing. But from Putin's point of view, so what? Everything is about the West. The interesting thing is, if you look at the next political generation down, the 50-something, the 60-something-year-olds, they're a lot more worried about China, because they see in the long term the risk that actually China essentially is such a black hole because of its money that Russia cannot do anything other than end up spinning around it in orbit. So I think for the moment, yes, basically China is the only game in town for Putin, even though there's a lot of people who are much less comfortable with that in Russia.
And then North Korea's place in all this, Hazel, clearly shares the anti-Western sentiment, but isn't a player in quite the same way?
Not at all. I mean, North Korea is a bit player of these countries that we're talking about. And I think really what makes me nervous is acronyms that get invented that really imply a spurious unity where none exists. The interesting thing about these four countries is, for me, and I think that my three colleagues have pointed this out, are the divisions between them on economics, on strategy, on values, basic values. And I think that what worries me is that when we've got these acronyms that bring them together, it misses the point in many ways. North Korea and Iran have had they've had arms sales relationships, but North Korea is incredibly suspicious of anything that can be seen as religious. I mean, its values really do matter. Mm. It's dependent on China, but it doesn't trust China. It has a historically difficult relationship with Russia, because although the Russians liberated Korea in 1945 at the end of the Second World War, they came in trying to tell the North Koreans what to do, which they can't stand. They think it's just, you know, that they know best on everything. So I think what worries me is that we don't want to miss the differences, the important differences, not just the economic differences between them. And this comes back to what somebody else said, which is that what we see now, I think, is a very transactional, you've got a coincidence of interests at the moment, in which you can say that these four countries are emitting all these anti-US slogans, are displaying antagonism towards the West. But frankly, they're not the only ones. So again, you'd have to think, well, what unites them? What really unites them as compared? Why don't you include Belarus in this? Or if it's about dictatorships, why not Saudi Arabia? Because it's not anti-US. So I think we've just got to be a little bit careful.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't that?
North Korea is a bit plain.
You start with the acronym and then work backwards on me. And so what should be the approach of Britain and the West to each of your countries, if you like? We've only got a couple of minutes left, because clearly, we, you know, they've tried bringing in China with the golden age, they tried bringing in Putin, bringing him in from the cold, and those things haven't worked. So what do you think we should do? I mean, let's start with you first, Mark. When it comes to Russia, I mean, clearly the war with Ukraine is focusing all minds on that. Can we do anything about Russia while that's ongoing and while Putin's still there?
2 minutes to define Russia policy. No problem. Yes, I think what we really need to do is precisely have a two-strand approach. Is on the one hand, absolutely, obviously, supporting Ukraine in its necessary struggle for its freedom and its sovereignty. But at the same time, bearing in mind there will be a Russia after Putin. I don't think there's any real scope for some kind of return to the status quo before February 2022. But Putin will go sooner or later. And I think at the same time, we need to be doing what we can to reach out to ordinary Russians and the lesser elite to basically say, we have a problem not with Russia, but with Putin and Putin's regime, and build, therefore, for the post-Russia, post-Putin era.
I wonder if there's overlaps with others. Richard Spencer in China, is it possible to make that same distinction in our relationships with Beijing?
Yeah, I think Beijing, it's obviously just a much bigger and more, I don't want to be rude about the importance of North Korea or even Russia. I mean, China is an opportunity and a threat and a challenge and all these things on such an enormous level because of just the scale of its population, the growth of its economy, and the interlinking because of that globalization with all our economies. I mean, what would our university sector be without the 150,000 Chinese students in Britain? You know, we may have been foolish to become to make our universities so dependent on Chinese money, but that's what we've done.
That's where we are.
That's where we are. I think, I mean, for me, on this issue, as with everything else to do with China, what we have to do is stop the hyperbole, which is incredibly unhelpful. So the golden age policy of David Cameron was, you know, to some of us just seemed absurd. The idea that you could just have this, you know, unmitigated love in with a dictatorship that clearly was a threat to Western interests, possibly, which was challenging Western values and was possibly a threat to Western friends and partners and interests in Asia and the Far East. Likewise, just dismissing it as a totalitarian monstrous state that, you know, that we want to have nothing to do with. I mean, it's just, is not what China is.
Yeah.
And B, it's completely unrealistic because we have to deal with it. It's a major power. It's a fifth of the world's population.
Really interesting conversation that. I will obviously look at the issues raised by the crinks in the coming weeks and months here on Politics Without the Boring Bits. Up next, 10 minutes to save Liz Truss.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk.
The Big Thing.
Hello, Liz Truss here. I hope you enjoy my new book, 10 Years to Save the West. Or, more accurately, should be 75 and a half Liz Trusses to save Liz Truss.
Yeah, she's back and she's got a book out. So good. 10 years to save the West, honestly. The former Prime Minister, she still wants to shake things up. She wants to sack the governor of the Bank of England, get rid of the pesky Office of Budget Responsibility, leave the European Court of Human Rights. Even Natural England's been getting it in the neck. So, we've read it so that you don't have to. Well, most of it. So today we're going to take a look at, and to be fair to Liz Truss, which is what some of you are saying we should be, non-stop cruelty towards Truss feels uncharitable, says one person who hasn't put their name on it. Maybe debate her criticisms of institutions with people who are not insiders, public sector, BBC types. Well, that's what we're going to try and do. Take some of what she says at face value and see, is there any truth in it? And I am joined now by the authors of Out of the Blue, the inside story of the unexpected rise and rapid fall of Liz Truss. The Sun's political editor, Harry Cole's here.
Morning, Matt.
Good to see you. The Spectator's James Hill as well.
Morning, Matt.
Hello, James. I note that Harry's come in, but that's fine, James. Kirsty Buchanan, former advisor to Liz Truss, which is much better now, is with us. Hi, Kirsty.
Good morning, Matt.
And because for some reason Liz wasn't available to come on the show, I'm not even sure if she's done an audiobook, because Bite Back, as she's done it with, don't normally do audiobooks. Mm. Anyway, so we've got the impressionist, Doreen Skinner, who's voiced up some of the best bits of the book. So Let's start with one of the standout moments where Liz Truss breaks the convention that you don't share your conversations with the monarch by repeating what happened when she met her namesake for her very first meeting and what last meeting with the late Queen.
I knew I'd never forget my last meeting with Her Majesty, and especially what she said towards the end of our talk in her drawing room. Being Prime Minister, she said, is incredibly ageing. She also gave me two words of advice. Pace yourself. Maybe I should have listened.
Now, the striking thing in the book, Harry, is that then later on, she completely contradicts herself and says, people told me to slow down, but what would I be waiting for? Do you think it would have made any difference if she'd listened to the late Queen and paced herself?
Yes, I personally do. She does not, and she's very adamant that, you know, the inevitable result was going to be the same, that the medicine was going to be disliked by all the same people. So, if anything, it sort of got it out of the way sooner rather later than dragging it on. I do think, and this is a strong, and I'm sure James agrees with me on this, because it's sort of the conclusion of our book, is that actually the death of the monarch was actually far more of a moment in this country than I think the politicians in charge at that particular moment, very newbie administration number 10, realised. And actually, that such a moment of significant massive upheaval for the nation, the last thing they needed to do was immediately then do the mini-budget straight away. She said, oh, we need to do the energy stuff, fine. But you didn't need to do all the other stuff immediately. She was running around saying, I've only got 2 years. She ended up with 2 months. So actually, I think the impact of the death of the sovereign should have taken everyone by, you know, they should have slowed down because of that, because they didn't need to have, the country's already in flux. You didn't need to add petrol to that flux. And I think that was one of the major reasons why I think it all got a little bit crazy so quickly.
Because the nation was basically already discombobulated.
Yes, totally, yeah. Completely. I mean, you've already gotten, it's big enough when you have a new prime minister, yeah. Really. To then have a new monarch, a new prime minister in the same week, and then try and upend 30 years of political consensus, but not a great move.
And James, it's interesting because also in the book, she's sort of dismissive, she seems dismissive of, I'm sure there are other prime ministers who would have been more statesman-like and they'd have had the sound bites and all of that. That's not really my thing. And you think, well, actually, the role of being prime minister, and it's very easy that we could all be sort of dismissive and a bit cynical and all that, but being prime minister is a huge deal. And part of the job is obviously, you know, writing your budgets and putting out your press releases and whatnot, but it's also leading the nation in moments of, you know, international upheaval, conflict, war, but, you know, pandemic, and prime ministers can do well or badly, that sort of thing. But being able to respond to the death of a monarch should be something in the toolkit, within the abilities of somebody who becomes prime minister. It's not something you can just dismiss, is it?
Yeah, I agree. And I think that every prime minister has their strengths and weaknesses. And I think it'd be fair to say that, you know, doing the kind of ceremonial set piece stuff was something that Liz didn't really particularly have a feel for. You know, she was, of course, once a famous teenage Republican. And I don't think that, she, you know, for instance, she would have done well of that as Rishi Sunak, who is quite polished at those kind of things. But you're right. And I think actually what's reading this book is two things were immediately striking to me. One of which is how this person, you know, spent 10 years in office, 8 years around the cabinet table, sort of long time climbing up the ladder, and yet so spectacularly ended so quickly in 7 weeks. And I think that needs to be sort of fleshed out, how the kind of, you know, you can play the game so well only to get to one point and get completely exposed. And the second thing which was so jarring, I think, was just how many of these criticisms we've heard before. You know, of course number 10 can be a bit like a cage, of course you're underfunded, of course it's a rickety old house in London. You know, they've been saying this since the days of Macmillan, and I think that, you know, what might have helped Liz Truss do better in office perhaps would be a greater appreciation of the kind of history and the context and challenges facing those in Downing Street and the predecessors who came before her.
So the interesting thing then, we'll come to that in a minute, because she talks about how she didn't have enough support in number 10. Kirsty, you worked with her when she was Justice Secretary. James there says she has different strengths and weaknesses. What would you identify as being her strengths?
She's calm in a crisis. So when I worked at Ministry of Justice, we just had one crisis after another. So I can say with some certainty that she's not a very flappable human being. And she has, for good or for ill, if you like, boundless amounts of resilience. So we had a riot, prison riot when we were there, the biggest prison riot in 25 years. We had a illegal prison officers strike. There was, violence and, illegal drugs were run riot throughout the prisons. And she, because she's a mathematician, she's a very methodical person. So she thought, right, let's approach this logically and we'll come to the point where logic will only get you so far in politics. But she said, right, is there or isn't there enough prison officers for the safety of the estate at the moment? No, there isn't. How many do we need to effect the right amount of safety on the estate? We need X amount of prison officers. What will that cost? Let's make a case to the Treasury. And to her credit, she got the money and got the officers trained up and into the estate. And it did begin to have some impact on the overall security of the estate. So when you've got a logical problem, she can approach it quite well. But politics is about people and about emotions and being able to take people with you. And you can't just, sometimes in politics, two and two doesn't make four. And I think she just thought, right, logically, you know, tax cuts are good. I believe in the Laffer curve. If we have tax cuts, growth will follow. And she seems to think that communication was the only problem here. But timing and communication, the ability to take people with you, are part and parcel of what makes a policy succeed or fail. And I think that's what we saw in quite spectacular form when she got to number 10.
Yeah, Jomo's just been in touch. Says, Liz Truss seems to have had no idea what the job of PM entailed, which does raise questions about her competences. Do you think that's fair, Howie?
I think it's probably fair. I don't think, forget, she's seen and sat at that cabinet table watching various different prime ministers fail for various different reasons. The hubris, perhaps, at the end of Cameron. The sort of, you know, horrible sort of slow bleeding out of Theresa May. Someone, you know, sort of trying to stick to one line, but, you know...
And not taking colleagues with her.
Whether or not, actually, I think... Perhaps for the defence, you could argue that could she take her colleagues with her? Really, there was a group of Tory MPs who were bitterly sore that they had lost the leadership election. They genuinely thought she was wrong. They genuinely didn't like her, and they genuinely wanted Rishi. And the problem that she had is that she almost gave up the campaign the day she won. And actually, that's when Rishi's team really actually started campaigning against her. So every turn, there was never... She didn't have the sort of political acute awareness to realise that actually you could see a world where Michael Gove, Grant Shapps, Sajid Javid were all brought into the tent, hugged nice and tightly, given nice little baubles, and they would have been out there spinning that mini budget to their heart's content. But the fact she came in so hard, pulled the shutters down, surrounded herself by loyalists and put all of her critics and enemies into the wilderness, you know, what do they do in the wilderness? They circled, they started circling the wagons. So it was, it was tricky, but it was a lack of political awareness. I think that you could almost see Boris Johnson did it very early on when he sort of came in and fired pretty much anyone that had ever been near any previous administration.
There was a lesson there of what happened.
And that eventually came back to bite him 2 years later because the people he fired were the ones, you know, on the airwaves all day saying how awful he was.
Okay, Liz, I want to be fair to her.
Did you just call me Liz?
No. I was going to say, let's be fair to her.
Okay.
Because she does raise some interesting points about life inside number 10.
Yes.
And I actually agree with her on this, but I'm not sure the conclusion that she makes is necessary. So here, this is Liz just talking about life inside number 10, which makes sound quite difficult.
I found the lack of personal support for the Prime Minister pretty shocking too. Despite now being one of the most photographed people in the country, I had to organise my own hair and makeup appointments. In short, there are a great many downsides to the job.
Now, I agree with her on the way that, you know, the Prime Minister lives in a pokey flat above number 11. You know, you have to send out a diary secretary to get you a Lemsip. You know, the hair and makeup at Doctors and Health, and, you know, there's a terrible... cafe in the basement of Downing Street. You've worked at Downing Street, Kirsty. What's your... She then obviously goes on to say that MPs are addicted to spending and she wants a small estate. So, but actually what she seems to be arguing for is there's a slightly deeper state, you might argue, to support the Prime Minister.
Yeah, I mean, look, none of this is a great revelation, is it? You know, it's well been known that there is appallingly little infrastructure to support a prime minister and clear the decks, if you like, of extraneous stuff so they could just concentrate on the job at hand. But I just kind of want to say, look, suck it up. There's a weird kind of dichotomy in this book. On the one hand, it's all about, you know, protecting liberal democracy and standing up about authoritarian states, and she wants to be the sort of champion, the crusader of liberal democracy across the world. And on the other hand, she's moaning about, you know, she needs to do her own makeup. And, you know, and what a terrible victim she's become by a boohoo having to be the prime minister and not being able to get her Ocado shopping in without some sort of drama. It's a very weird book. It's a little bit like, it reminds me a little bit of like the Nadine Dorries book, isn't it? There's somewhere between fact and fiction and kind of all over the place. And it's almost like a genre in its own right. And I think if you're going to get fact and fiction and merge them together, you get faction, which is probably about right for Tory literature, right? But yeah, I mean, look, you wanted to be the prime minister. You know it comes with a lot of hurdles, and doing your own makeup is the very least of them.
And there's a very weird bit as well, James, where she complains that she was felt cooped up and she couldn't just go wandering the streets of London. And you say, you're the prime minister of one of the, you know, military and economic powers of the globe. Of course you can't just wander outside.
Yeah, and I mean, some other prime ministers, I think John Major once talked about how he wanted to sort of go down to the shops and get a Wimpy Burger, and obviously he was unable to do so. But I mean, this has come through the job.
That's such a John Major thing.
I do agree with Kirsty here, which is that, you know, on the one hand, you can't really sort of enjoy all the benefits of public office while also not taking the constraints. I do think, though, that, you know, she does have a point about, you know, security. I remember, like, Robert Harris talking about when Tony Blair became prime minister. He was there on the 9th of the 1907 election, and when he got the house, there was no one. I think there was a single policeman outside. And when he left it, there was a whole sort of, you know, bunch of special branch, etc., in the bushes. And that basically, his life was never the same again. Mm. But that is what the office entails. And if you are going to stand for leadership, that's what you have to come with it.
I think both Kirsty and James are right there. There are lots of points. It's sort of almost a microcosm of the entire book here, is that there are lots of points that lots of people agree with Liz Truss on. They just don't necessarily agree to be the person that makes it. Politicians moaning about the trappings of office, yeah, Never going to work. But at the same time, we are, as you write, say, the second biggest power in NATO, sixth largest economy in the world, member of the Security Council. We're a proper country, yet we sort of flagellate ourselves, like whip ourselves into righteous fury about the idea that we have a plane that, you know, every other single world leader, yeah, of much smaller countries has, and we get very upset because a prime minister might use a helicopter. And it's just think that this debate needs to be had. Are we a proper country or are we not? The person that had to lead that debate isn't necessarily, yes, the person at the centre.
But also, party leaders are also to blame, because David Cameron made a big fuss of it before he became prime minister. He was going to make ministers go on the bus.
And he used to have his hair cut on CCHQ's tab, and
exactly,
so did Boris Johnson.
And then, you know, right, you know, Keir Starmer's doing the same thing with Rishi Sunak and his helicopter. And I've asked Keir Starmer before, will you use helicopters? And he's like,
it'll be on the advice of the police.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right, let's turn our attention then to the economy. Clearly, that's the dominant story of Liz Truss's time in parliament as prime minister. It's the one she goes into great detail about in her book. So let's have another extract.
Wozzy and I agreed there was a triumvirate of problems. The Treasury, the Bank of England, and the Office for Budget Responsibility. I have heard many people say we should have gone slower, delayed the announcements, and rolled the pitch better. I accept the communications around the mini budget were not as good as they could have been, but I have to ask, what would we have been waiting for? If anyone was surprised by the measures in the growth plan, they frankly hadn't been paying attention. Part of the problem we faced was a distinct shortage of expert voices supporting our agenda. Broadcasters and press alike struggled to find economics and commentators who could explain what we were trying to do.
That is some extracts from Liz Truss's book, read by Noreen Skinner for us, because Liz wasn't available. Let's bring in Mark Littlewood, who is now the director of Popcorn UK, which is the group that Liz Truss has been part of, but was also, he was previously at the Institute for Economic Affairs, used to come on the show a lot to make precisely the sort of economic arguments that Liz was making. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Matt. Good to be with you.
Good to have you back. What's your reading of it? Do you think it would have made any difference if Liz Truss had taken the advice of the late Queen and had gone slower?
I'm not sure slower would have worked. I mean, I think the interesting kind of case that Liz puts forward, it's not quite as binary as this, but sort of you can survive if you pretty much do nothing.
It's quite a long list, Harry, of mainly acronyms, economic acronyms that she's declaring war on. Has she she's not alone on the Tory benches in thinking
not
some of this.
Not in the slightest, no. And, you know, the OBR and their forecast, the Bank of England last week admitted their forecasts have been woefully inaccurate. You know, other politicians have got away with not doing OBR spending. The reason that the OBR thing became such a big deal was because Mel Stride was the chairman of the Treasury Select Committee, who was hammering it, saying, if this has to be done by the OBR, and he was Rishi Sunak's campaign manager.
Yeah.
So the idea that this OBR is a sacred cow that cannot be touched, I think is, you know, that's a widespread view on the Labour benches, and I think on the Tory benches, and some of the Labour benches think that Keir Starmer's making a rod for his own back by promising to in fact increase the powers of the OBR when in fact they should be going the other way.
So yeah, you were asking about, you know, would slower have worked? You know, could perhaps the measures in the mini budget, I don't know, being rolled out over 3 or 5 or 6 different fiscal events? Possibly, I suppose, but that raises the rather important issue of sort of, you know, who's in charge here and you know, when do you make decisions and why would you delay? And I just heard, I think it was Harry there, sort of saying that, you know, the OBR is, we almost worship at its altar, despite the fact that its forecasting, unsurprisingly, I should say, is often wildly inaccurate because economic forecasting is extremely difficult. But you almost get the sense now that sort of Richard Hughes, the head of the OBR, and their judgment about fiscal headroom, so-called, how much money does the government have to play with, is the more determining feature of a budget than what Rishi Sunak, Jeremy Hunt, Liz Truss, or Kwasi Kwarteng might want to do. So as we heard from your extract, I think Truss admits that the communications around the mini-budget were poor. But would it have been any easier to have delayed, to have hoped that the OBR would say there was more fiscal headroom in 6 months' time? Probably not. So I think the rather glum conclusion for those of us who want to see the sort of reforms that Truss and Kwarteng were trying to bring about is that it's a bit of an exercise in pushing water uphill. It seems extraordinarily difficult to bring those things about with the present institutional infrastructure we have. Perhaps if Liz Truss had gone more slowly, she would have lasted more than 49 days, but she probably wouldn't have lasted much more than 100. So that raises quite big questions, I think, about how we structure our decision-making and our economic policy-making in the United Kingdom. And I would get rid of the OBR. There are plenty of forecasters in the United Kingdom. You don't need another one specifically run by the state or rather paid for by the state. And in fact, the OBR's forecasts have tended to sort of be a bit poor compared to those from Capita Economics or JP Morgan or the rest. So, of course, the Chancellor and the Prime Minister should look at forecasts, but do we need this particular state-financed independent forecaster? I would say no.
But I suppose that we could talk a lot. There's like lots of individual parts in all of that, Mark. But the central case is Liz Truss said what she was going to do during the leadership campaign. Mm-hmm. Other people, including Rishi Sunak, her opponent in that race, said, if you do that, you'll push up interest rates, you'll crash the economy. You cannot have unfunded tax cuts. If you're going to promise tax cuts, they have to be paid for. If you do unfunded tax cuts, you crash the economy. She did unfunded tax cuts. Everything that everyone told her would happen, happened. So it's not that, you know, the deep state then brought her down for doing this unpopular thing. The thing that everyone said would happen, happened.
Yeah, but hang on a second, Matt. I mean, I don't think that the cause and effect is quite as straightforward as you just put it there.
No, but do you think, I mean, ultimately, the thing that she's, with a bit of a nudge and a wink, pushing in this book, is that for some reason, which she doesn't fully explain, there are a lot of people in the political and economic establishment who don't like growth, and therefore were so opposed to her pursuing growth that they connived in shadowy rooms to bring her down so that we could continue the status quo of prime ministers who don't like growth. That's the sort of message that she's...
Yeah, I mean, I think actually, Matt, that's a bit of a caricature. I don't think Liz would say, and I certainly wouldn't say, that there's a kind of army of bureaucrats who are hell-bent on stopping GDP growth.
That's exactly what she's talking about. She talks about a left-wing economic establishment.
Yeah, but I think it is true to say that the bureaucracy in general, they're not necessarily conspiring with each other, but the groupthink and the mindset is of a particular bent. It doesn't have very dynamic economic modelling.
Yeah, but didn't it turn out, Mark, that bent was against billions of pounds worth of unfunded tax cuts?
Well, then my question to you, Matt, would be, why has nobody been worried about nearly £1 trillion of unfunded government spending. Unfunded government spending doesn't seem to be much of a problem. We've doubled the national debt in the last 10 or 15 years. So spending money on government projects, unfunded and racking up deficits, which we've done since 2001, that seems fine if it's state spending, is that right? But the minute that you might have a few billion pounds of tax cuts that might add to the deficit,
yeah, but isn't the proper conservative position not to have masses and masses of borrowing and debt?
1,000%, I agree with you, and in fact,
arguing in favour of unfunded tax cuts, but adding to the borrowing and debt.
No, I'm just saying that if unfunded tax cuts are a problem that puts the economy into tailspin, then the vastly greater unfunded public spending over the past 15 years should have brought us to our knees. And of course, what Truss would point out, I think rightly, is that some of the cuts that she wanted to make, for example, she wanted to ensure that welfare benefits, the welfare bill, only went up with wages, not high inflation. That would have been, in real terms, a public spending cut. But there were not sufficient people in her party to support that. So politically, she couldn't navigate through what would have been a quite substantial damper on welfare.
And that goes
spending,
so that goes
there
back
wasn't
to the
political will to do it.
She came in and said she wanted to deliver, deliver, deliver. How was it she couldn't deliver you a period?
She did our best, but there's a, you know, there, without sending two conspiracy theorists, like there's this mysterious committee called HOLAC, who've never reached out to me, spoken to me, but apparently they have the power over deciding whether my name goes forward or not. So I've clearly done something to irritate them, but if you spend most of your adult life trying to irritate the political establishment, I guess that's the price you pay, Matt.
I suspect that means I'm not going to get a peerage either. Kirsty Buchanan, let's bring you in there. What do you make of all that?
Look, I think you'll be unsurprised to think that I think Liz has learned the wrong lessons from this, or at least is putting forward the wrong argument. She wasn't bought down by a secret cabal or groupthink of left-wing blobbery. She was bought down by classic elements of the right. You know, markets are made up of people. They're not some weird algorithm in a corner somewhere. And when you land £45 billion worth of unfunded tax cuts on the market, you're going to spook the market. And the market spooked. And that's what we saw. And then the Conservative colleagues pulled their support from her. That's what brought her down. And anything to argue that this is about some sort of secret, you know, establishment, not bad. And look, you know, there are things in the book that are true and right, and I agree with. She's 100% right about the OBR. It's more wrong than it's right. And it blows my mind that it's still in existence, given how wrong it is and why anybody would want to constrain themselves by its rulings. But, you know, but there are bits of it that are right. But this fundamental tenet of the book, that she was brought down because she was a disruptor that wanted to challenge the establishment, is not true. She was brought down because she doesn't read people very well. She was warned it would spook the markets, and it did spook the markets. And the markets, you know, oh, the irony klaxon alert, you know, free marketeer was brought down by the markets. That's the reality of it. But
there's one massive bit of spending we haven't talked about. The energy price plan was far more spooky to the markets than the tax cuts. They didn't, you know, she basically just, you know, having spent all summer saying, you know, we'll have a look, but not committing to anything, she gets into office under immense political pressure, announces a massive, the biggest market intervention ever in this country, yet obviously that was the same day the Queen died, so no one noticed it. But I think it went on page 18 of the paper.
Yeah.
So you've got to look at it, it's not just the tax cuts, it's also the massive underfunded spending cuts.
And you can make the case, well, it was the right thing to do to the energy thing because people were facing massive
bills. Was it the right thing to do?
Well, but because, that was,
politically, it was the right thing to do at that time, but actually, you know, a far more targeted thing.
They're coming along and dumping another load of spending on top.
And then just on a matter of fairness, no one's saying it's a smoke filled room of conspiracy around her, but she was running directly into a wall of opposition, and that opposition went from everyone, from President Biden, who made a fairly outrageous intervention in British politics because he was in the middle of a midterm campaign and he wanted to weaponize the idea of tax cuts which the Republicans were pushing. So that was pretty unprecedented. The IMF still very suspicious about that. And also the failings of the Bank of England cannot be underplayed in the fact that there was a tinderbox, I think what she described as. She didn't have to light it, but there was a tinderbox there that the Bank of England hadn't told anyone, that the pensions market was massively overexposed. And I do think that a certain amount of blame has to go that way as well as to Truss. So it wasn't this idea of a sort of deep state conspiracy, but there was a, you know, I think she's got a point about the there is a consensus that tax cuts boo, public spending yay. Yeah. And you know,
but if that's
like
the consensus you're in, then you need to do something
totally,
to change the consensus.
And so I think comms is a bit of an understatement on that.
Finally then, in a one word answer to all of you, will she come back? Harry?
She hasn't gone away.
No, but is she party leader, shadow cabinet?
I think ideological lodestar of an ever increasingly up and down faction of the Tory party.
James?
Goldwater aspirant.
Kirsty?
Big in America.
Big in America. Mark?
No, I don't think she'll hold high office again, but I don't think she's going away either. This isn't the last you'll hear from her.
There we are. That's Mark Littlewood there. Let's play us out then with one last clip from our very own Liz Truss.
That afternoon, I had a short press conference to announce the U-turn on corporation tax and explain what the new Chancellor and I would be doing to ensure economic stability. I faced the media frenzy alone. It was a pretty ghastly experience, which felt a lot like officiating at my own funeral.
Well, that was a lot of fun, and we've saved you the bother of reading the thing now. If you want to get in touch with me, you can email me, matt@times.radio. You can WhatsApp 0333 003 2353. But for now, for me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.